This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Are you worried about the level of debt that's accumulating to accomplish almost what seems to be like a break-even GDP?
Yeah, debt is an enormous problem. It's an exceptionally enormous problem, but it's not a problem for today. And that's a hard thing to say, and it's a hard thing for people to accept. And it's really one of the reasons why we have this deflationary environment to begin with, because for various reasons, the primary way that this Eurodollar global US dollar system works is through something called repo, the repurchase agreements, which are collateralized lending. And so we've given primacy to that collateral and its importance in liquidity and monetary supply throughout the entire world, which means we need that collateral. Without that collateral, the system breaks down, which is really what happened in 2008, by the way. It was a collateral shortage, which is one reason why the Fed couldn't fix it. But, you know, not getting into that, when you have a collateral shortage, what happens is essentially everybody gets herded into the best forms of collateral. And unfortunately, U.S. government debt consists of the best form of collateral. So in times of deflation and collateral scarcity, guess what everybody wants to own? The one thing that they probably shouldn't long term, because we all know the U.S. government is the brokest institution that human beings have ever conceived. But as I said, that's a tomorrow problem. The today problem is I need collateral. U.S. government, U.S. Treasury bonds, and really U.S. Treasury bills are the best form of collateral. So their value that value in that debt is maintained by this monetary insufficiency. It's almost a paradox in and of itself, right? Because the more the government debt is utilized and valued in this collateral form of collateralized form of lending, this necessary process in the global Eurodollar system, the more the U.S. government can take advantage of those prices and issue more and more debt. And of course, that doesn't solve the economic equation, which just simply means we're going to have more deflation, lack of economic growth, and therefore more need, or more, at least more. It's going to result in more borrowing by the federal government to begin with. This perfectly describes the last dozen years or so since the ARRA. We've gone into this cycle where we can't break out of it.
Take me through a repo transaction.
Oh, it's simply...
There's two sides of it.
Right? Yes.
Okay.
You know, a simple unsecured transaction like federal funds is, you know, you're a bank, I'm a bank, I lend you cash overnight, you pay it back, you pay me back tomorrow with principal plus a little bit of interest. That's all. And we do that because we know each other, we're in the marketplace all the time. So that's an unsecured transaction. And before 2007, there was a lot of that kind of activity that went on. Obviously, you can see, you know, the financial crisis, why banks would not want to do that as much afterward. But even before 2007, the alternative to that is something called repo. And repo is nothing more than you want to borrow cash from me, but I don't know who you are. I need some kind of security or collateral.
Right.
So you have some kind of security or collateral that you post to me. And if you default on the cash loan in the morning, I seize your collateral and I sell it. That's all it is. So that's a repo transaction.
Are there times when somebody comes to the door and says, I have this as an asset, and the other side goes, we don't loan on that?
Absolutely. And that's really kind of where it gets into big problems, because what happens is if you say you have a really crappy junk bond, corporate bond from a really low quality issuer,
right,
you go into the repo market will say, yeah, I'll take that as collateral, but with a huge haircut, which means a huge markdown in price.
Right.
So you say, well, I don't want to use the junk bond because I'm going to have to pay that huge markdown. I'm going to have to use a lot more collateral. I'm going to knock on the door of a money dealer and I'm going to exchange my collateral for a U.S. Treasury. So I'm going to essentially borrow a U.S. Treasury from a bank and then I'm going to go into the repo market. And as far as the repo market goes, as far as I know, you're coming to me with a U.S. Treasury. So we're going to do a repo trade on U.S. on the best possible terms, even though that's not your treasury that you own. You've borrowed it from a bank. And really underpinning this whole process is real crappy collateral. So we have what looks like good collateral being supported by crappy collateral. Now, you do that a couple hundred thousand times. This is called reuse and repledging, rehypothecation. You do that quite a lot. It's suddenly the collateral stream becomes very important to the function, the monetary function of the overall system. If we have a collateral problem, What happens if the bank that you're borrowing the treasury from suddenly says, I don't like this junk that you're posting to me to borrow my treasury, give me my treasury back, which you got to give the treasury back, which that means you can't go in the repo market tomorrow, which is going to cause all sorts of problems to you because you're highly leveraged. You don't have any cash margin for this kind of thing. So either you're going to have to find a replacement treasury at whatever price you can secure, or you're going to have to start selling off your assets. You have to liquidate your assets at whatever price you can get. So you can see lack of collateral causes all sorts of problems, including increasing the price of the good forms of collateral. And when these collateral scarcity periods get really, really acute, that's when you see US Treasury prices, especially bill prices, go up in sustained fashion. You know, that's when you see real rallies in the Treasury market, when there's a collateral shortage.
Okay.
And of course, that's, you know, the deflationary implications that go along with it.
Let's try to build a picture of what causes deflation, and maybe there's some new pieces to it, like AI and things like that. So first of all, our current demographics, is that deflationary?
I don't think it's necessarily deflationary. I understand. I mean, it's sort of economic theory going way back, but I think there are periods in time where, you know, you can look at it and say, it's not necessarily a deflationary outcome. It's certainly not, it's not helpful, but I don't think it's necessarily a foregone conclusion.
What about the labor participation rate?
That's hugely deflationary. And that to me is a macro factor, which is, you know, it's not that there's rigidities in the labor system. You know, Americans are too lazy, they're too drug addicted, baby boomers, all that kind of stuff. I don't believe that at all. I think what's happened is that because of the deflationary environment where the US economy hasn't really grown that well since 2008, most people are saying, it's not worth it for me to even look for a job because I know there isn't one available at the rate I want to get paid. And it's also about wages, right? Companies in a low growth environment aren't able to pay the market clearing wage. And so the participation problem is a symptom of this overall deflation, and it contributes to it because it creates this massive amount of hidden macro slack in the labor pool.
Okay.
Which has only gotten worse since last year. The participation rate dropped precipitously, and it's only come about halfway back. So as bad as it was before COVID and the 2020 recession, so far it's maintaining itself at 61.5, 61.6, which is not a good number. That's a really low number.
Okay, things like inventions, technology, AI, does that play a role in deflation? And is that just a trend that's going to get more aggressive?
Productive deflation like that, I mean, that's what capitalism does. That's rising living standard of social progress. And so the backbone of economic progress, which becomes inflationary, is that productive deflation. As we adopt new innovative ideas that increase the efficiency and the pliability of the overall economic system, we would expect that to contribute to growth, not inhibit it. So yeah, that kind of thing is going on. It's always going on. We can see it. I mean, the price of technology goes down all the time. However, what's happening is that we're not taking advantage of innovations because of this monetary economic insufficiency. We're not really investing in those types of innovations and technologies because we can't. The system is not working. It's broken down. We can't take advantage of these things at the same rate we used to. And that's really, it all comes back to that deflationary component, which is a monetary macro deflation, not necessarily a productive deflation.
Okay. Things like automatic cars, you know, driving cars, things like that. Is that, obviously that's a progression, but is that deflationary? Like if you take out truck drivers, for instance.
Absolutely. I mean, go back 100 years. If you lived in New York City and you walked in any tall building, you didn't press a button on an elevator. You talked to the person who did it, who moved the elevator manually. We don't have elevator operators anymore. And we don't lament the fact that they're gone. So, but the problem is, look, we went through these transformations, big transformations in a lot of different times. I mean, in the 19th century, the start of the 19th century, American workers were by and large agricultural.
Right.
At the end of the 19th century, there were hardly any agricultural workers left. We didn't, you know, I mean, that was a messy process, a lot of upheaval and things like that. But by and large, those agriculture workers moved into industrial jobs because there was industrial jobs. There was economic growth that and that supported that transformation. I think what's happening now is, especially since 2007, 2008, is that we do have some of those transformation pressures, you know, the fear of the robot, for example.
Right.
But we don't have the jobs available, the new jobs available to absorb those kinds of processes. And so that gives a lot of power to and amplifies these fears. But it's not really, you shouldn't be fearing the robot taking over. You should be instead really upset about the fact there isn't a job ready available for you because you're now freed up to do something else. Because truck drivers would be freed up to do something else other than driving a truck. That's really the secret to economic progress in advance, is that, you know, you used to toil away, you know, 18 hours a day in a farm for very little pay. Then all of a sudden you got a factory job. To our modern era, that didn't sound like much of an improvement, but it really was. It was a major step toward the middle class. You know, as long as there was jobs available for to take advantage of these technological progresses and productive deflationary processes, it kind of worked. Again, it was messy. It was, you know, a lot of upheaval, migrations and things like that. By and large, it not only did it work, it was enormously successful. We transformed society from, you know, subsistence existence into a modern industrial consumer driven wealthy state. And now what comes next?
Okay.
And the fact that we don't have a labor market that's sufficient to really take advantage of it.
Do you expect there to be a positive outcome from what we have to now go through? Let's say there's going to be upheaval, but you feel like we're going to land in a positive square at some point.
At some point. And that's really the key. You know, it's been 14 years already, which is way longer than it ever should have been. But, you know, these things are not permanent. Eventually, you know, human beings will find a success. Human beings will find a way to break out of their problems. Even, you know, historically speaking, yes, prolonged periods of economic, recession or depression, whatever you want to call it, for lack of a better term, they do happen, but they don't last forever. So really it's about, you know, when does this one end and what does it look like when we get into the next real legitimate upturn? And I think it could be enormously profitable, enormously opportunistic for everybody. You know, rising tide lifts all boats. It's really about solving this deflationary problem that we're currently stuck with and getting it out into the open and fixing it. And then watching everything finally, you know, we've got a decade and a half already of pent up demand and really investments, legitimate investments. I'm not talking about malinvestment into all the sorts of financial products and things like that, but legitimate investment that's pent up, ready to go and some taking advantage of a lot of technological innovation that we've really scratched the surface with.
So these advances are going to eliminate jobs, but you feel confident there'll be another group of jobs that emerge from whatever's next. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that's kind of the process. It's like I said, it's not necessarily a straightforward process. It tends to be messy. I mean, if you're if you're a truck driver, for example, and your job's eliminated, you're not going to feel too great about this.
Yeah, that's messy.
No. And you know, hey, I grew up in the Rust Belt. So okay. I saw what happened with all those industrial jobs just kind of disappeared. Yep. And we're supposed to just be happy that they all went to Vietnam and China. No, I mean, again, it's not a straightforward process where everybody's happy with it. But by and large, if it worked the way it was supposed to work, then we would, you know, that's where economic progress as a whole in general comes from. And that's small comfort to the person who is displaced. It's like, hey, you got to sacrifice your job so that the quote unquote greater good can advance. And, you know, everybody else can have a much better future, but you have to change and you have to learn some kind of other career. But, you know, that's the way economics work. That's the way economic progress since the Industrial Revolution showed up. That's the way it's been.
What do you view interest rates doing over the next couple of years?
I think they're going lower and lower and lower. And I would not be surprised if at some point we see negative treasury yields. And outside of the bills, we've already seen bill yields go negative at certain times for those reasons I talked about, you know, collateral and shortage and things like that. But I think I would not be surprised to see some of the note yields go negative at some point.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, I know. It's sort of like the stark disconnect, right? I just talked about how happy I am about the future, but you know, how do we get there? Right. I mean, that's really the issue here is how do we get from A to B? where A is really bad. It's this deflationary environment. Really, the worst case is that we stay with it for prolonged, even more. You know, to me, almost another crash or crisis would be preferable, because it might get people to start looking in the right place and say, let's fix this now. Whereas what we have now, most people don't really know what's going on. In fact, if you ask most people, especially before 2020, they would tell you, what the hell are you talking? I mean, what are you talking about? The economy's booming. Haven't you seen the unemployment rate? It's the 50-year low. What do you mean we're in a deflationary period where things aren't good? It's very hard to get people to connect all these dots, starting with the fact that they don't know there's a problem. And that's really the issue.
You know, you've mentioned quite a few times the bond market. So is the bond market a collective of very bright people? I mean, in other words, they're not one guy going, okay, this is what's going to happen. So why is the bond market most often correct in direction pointing?
When we go back to what I described of the monetary system, this Eurodollar system, it's a bank-centered system where we're not trading actual currency, we're trading bank liabilities and assets back and forth. And we described one in our simple repo example. That's what money is. So the bond market is essentially these banks who do the money, they're the ones with the printing press, telling you what they're doing. So if the people who are doing the money are saying, I'm risk averse, I'm not really seeing the inflation, we should probably listen to that signal. I'm not saying we should, you know, we need to look around for corroboration in other markets and other things, but if the monetary system itself could talk to you and tell you deflation, disinflation, you would probably want to listen to that. So that's what we're really talking about. We look at yield curves and money curves and things like that. The investors in those bond markets, the investor in Eurodollar futures or interest rate swaps or currency swaps, that is the monetary system itself telling you what the monetary system is doing. That's why, number one, the bond market has an enviable, rather than Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve, poor track record. And number two, it's been consistent. It tells you when monetary pressures go up, we can expect these deflationary symptoms to arise, and they do consistently. So that's why we look at the bond market, because by and large, it's the monetary system telling you what it's doing in real time.
What's interesting about what's happening to yields, I'll just give you an example. So when interest rates went to 17% for mortgage rates in 1980, so from 75 to 80, interest rates over doubled, 7.5 to 17.
Yep.
That journey also took prices up by 300%. So when people tell me, well, rising interest rates kill real estate, you know, that's why I like charts to go, well, wait a minute, that's not always true. But here's the problem now, that there's an affordability that's repetitive where there becomes a problem for, I'll just speak California. So we're approaching that affordability breaking point where prices basically stop accelerating. The problem is we were at 17% in 1980 when that occurred, and we're in the twos when it might occur now.
Right.
So how do you go forward whenever you normalize interest rates, whatever time frame that is? The debt on the real estate, if it's at 2% or something, and the new debt has got to be at 5 or 6, which is not an outrageous interest rate historically.
I know, it sounds like it though, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course.
That's
yeah.
How bad.
Oh yeah.
Always, 5%, you know, oh my God.
I do a lot of speaking and people were, you know, they'll raise their hand. You know, I'm hesitating to refi because interest rates are 3.25, you know? And I'm just like, wow. You know,
how lucky you are.
Yeah, take a longer chart before you say that. Yeah. You know, you're looking at a 6-month chart and are unhappy. I guess what I'm concerned about is when interest rates normalize.
Which they will.
You're going to have.
They will. Okay. They will at some point. Absolutely.
Then real estate has used up all of the upside for a really fairly long period of time. Now, what's your thought about? Because.
Well, Bruce, if you like, I'll make a little bit of a counter argument to that.
Sure.
Which is essentially, when interest rates normalize, and normalize is probably, you know, not the right term, but interest rates get out of this disinflation, deflationary environment and get to something more recognizable as normal. You know, go back to the 1990s, for example. Where were interest rates in the 90s? You know, they're about 5, 6, 7% short run. And so, okay, you know, mortgage rates were 8, maybe 9, 10, 10% somewhere in there.
Right.
And that was good. That was an environment with legitimate economic growth pretty much all around the world. Everybody was doing very well. And that's what we want to see. We want to see interest rates rise in the bond market because that's the signal. That's the monetary system telling you we're going into a period where economic growth is legitimate economic growth. And if we get into a robust economic growth paradigm, maybe that softens the blow of the rise in interest rates. In fact, that's really what we expect to happen, not just specifically in real estate, but in all sorts of other, you know, leverage categories like, you know, productive investment, companies borrowing money. In a macro environment that is conducive to that kind of that thing paying off, companies wouldn't necessarily, you know, balk at higher interest rates because they would be looking at the long run opportunity of that productive investment. Now, I know it's a little bit different in real estate, but a really roaring economic system could actually cushion the blow to rising rates in the real estate environment because you would have more people involved in real estate. And I think that's one of the problems over the last, especially since the housing bust in 2008, 9, and 10, is that the real estate sector has sort of been walled off from a large portion of the population who can't get a mortgage even if they tried. So if you have a real economic growth situation, we could bring a lot more people back into the real estate market and maybe all of these things work in the market's favor. Okay. Now that's, I may sound like threading the needle, but that's sort of really what we want, what we expect to happen by and large. That's really the idea behind rising interest rates and economic growth. And I think it's worth pointing out too, maybe outside of the real estate investors, most people have interest rates upside down. They think low rates are stimulus and high rates are, you know, some form of restriction. When what you just said is absolutely true. Rates were double digits and better in the 1970s during the great inflation, whereas low rates today don't signal stimulus, they signal tight money. And that's what Milton Friedman called the interest rate fallacy, because historically speaking, it's exactly the opposite the way you're taught. We're all taught to believe the Fed controls interest rates and it raises and lowers them, when that's not true. The bond market, the monetary system does. And if the bond market is buying safe and liquid instruments, what does that tell you about the liquidity environment into which they're buying those instruments? Mm-hmm. It's exactly backwards. So if we see a normalization of interest rates, that will tell us a loosening of money. Therefore, economic prospects go way, way up.
So the cost of your mortgage and interest rate probably gets countered by your wage just went up.
Yes, not just your wage, but your neighbor's wage who hasn't been working in 15 years. All of a sudden, he's got a job. Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, that's the idea. And it's, you know, we can paint ideal scenarios all we want. How realistic is that kind of a thing? I think in my opinion, I think that's probably a very realistic scenario, but it's a complicated process and it's always messy and things are mistimed. And it's sort of in the long run, what does it look like? And that's really the problem.
So if you're borrowing money on your real estate now, it seems like you're basically doing it for free if you're going forward and having some inflation of that. So that's very interesting. Well, I think I have asked everything. I really appreciate your input. It's not a subject that I'm an expert on, Jeff. And I've listened to your podcast many times and I've enjoyed them. And it just kind of spurred this interview because I thought, I just watched one a couple of nights ago and then you brought up the Euro dollar system. And I thought, wow, I am not familiar with that. And I just found that very interesting.
But it's not something that you're allowed to talk about in mainstream circles because it's a topic that's verboten. You're supposed to believe that the Federal Reserve prints money, end of story, nothing else. You know, that's what QE is. QE is supposed to be money printed, and it's not. And when you tell people that, they're like, wait a minute, everybody says it's money printing. And then you started to get into the background of discussion of what is actually money. It's so counterintuitive. It's so contradictory that a lot of people have trouble accepting it. And that's why I usually bring up the scholarship behind it, which is if you listen to these central bankers talk through here, Alan Greenspan in particular, he admits to all of these things. He said in June of 2000, for example, that inflation is always a monetary phenomenon. We can't define money. So we're kind of really flying blind here. And it shows. I mean, when you look at 2008 and 2009, so this global financial crisis, the only way you can really explain how it was global is this monetary system that the Fed really isn't plugged into, because that's really what it, when you look at it, that's what really happened. And all these other interesting things like collateral, they play the central role, not the Fed in its quantitative easing stuff.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks.
Jeff, can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
Just really quick. You talk about in history, you know, this situation and then this happened to fix it. This situation and then this happened to fix it. Is there a possibility that this doesn't get fixed?
I don't see that. I think that, I mean, it could take a long time because, I mean, we're already 14 years and we haven't really made much progress. I mean, there is actually some progress. For example, if you look at mainstream scholarship from the ECB, they have started to take a look at collateral and these what they call secured financing transactions, SFTs. So, I mean, there is slow but steady progress. I mean, just this year, the Federal Reserve in its FOMC statement said, is in a sort of vague nod and cryptic nod to collateral, there are times when you have money market breakdowns, even though our reserves are sufficient or overabundant or abundant, whatever they want to call it. So there's, you know, it's taken a lot of time for people, even in these positions of authority who have vested interest, to not look at this stuff, that they are actually investigating. So even though progress has been very, very, very slow, it is being made even now. So there is some reason to believe that at some point, even these idiots can figure it out and maybe finally, you know, lead to some kind of constructive solution. But I believe that that's the case. However, I think there's another way that this could, quote unquote, be fixed, which is probably not what we want, where we go further and further into social and political fragmentation, which leads to, we're just going to scrap the system and start over with something else, which is entirely dangerous, but also entirely possible. So I don't think this kind of condition can go on forever. And I think there's, you know, I don't want to make it sound like there's only two different options. It's a binary tree, right? It's either really bad or really good. You know, there's any number of ranges in between. But that's, I think we're getting toward that the point where it becomes untenable and something has to happen.
Is there somebody that you look to or you, a voice that you respect that, you know, is usually on the, you know, on the cutting edge or usually gets this right?
There's really not. That's, you know, that's why I've in the last year, of course, with crypto prices going through the roof, people have started to talk about digital assets and digital currency and DeFi and all these other things. I think that's really where we're going. I think those are the answers to this problem. And I think the problem with that is the investors who are piling into crypto are doing it for the wrong reasons. They're doing it because they think the Fed's printing money, the dollar's going to go to zero. That's certainly the position of Bitcoin maximalists who believe the Fed has screwed everything up and that's really what's going to happen. I don't think that's what's really going on in digital crypto either. They're taking advantage of the opportunity presented to them by this inelastic, deflationary monetary shortage system where, you know, El Salvador is a perfect example. El Salvador has a dollar problem, can't get enough dollars. So they've said, let's try Bitcoin. So that's, I think that's what's really going on in crypto, is it's pushing its way into this monetary shortage, deflationary situation, even though the people who are buying it as investors are buying for the inflationary wrong reasons. So, you know, it's kind of a disconnect, but I think, you know, the technology, the potential for digital currencies is there, that it could actually provide an elegant solution to the situation that we're in. So there's, you know, that's another reason to be optimistic about the future, is that even if we don't realize it, there are very smart people working on solutions, even if those smart people don't necessarily realize what they're really doing either.
Are you, you know, the gentleman, Raoul Paul?
Yes.
Yeah. I've had an opportunity to interview him. He's a very interesting man. I respect what he's done with the education space for sure. And you've been interviewed on the show, right?
I've been on Real Vision several times over the years. I was one of the first guests, actually, I think, way back, you know, 5 years ago.
That's great. All right, Jeff.
Yeah, hey. And I think that what Raoul has done with Real Vision is an example of what we're talking about here. It may be unappreciated innovation. Just, you know, I'll be brief here. What he essentially saw was that, you know, CNBC, Bloomberg channels, they had to fill content 24 hours a day, and it was essentially throwaway content. And so the quality of the content got down to throwaway content. What he said was, we don't have to fill a 24-hour day. We'll just produce really good content and make it available all the time. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like such a simple thing, But yet he was kind of the first guy to put these two things together. And it's, I think that's the model everybody's working to. I mean, you look at the way people consume entertainment now, there's a lot of people don't even have television. They just watch YouTube clips, for example. So we're moving in that direction, and that's a positive direction that's, you know, maybe unappreciated, and I think not taken advantage of because of the environment behind it.
All right. Well, Jeff, it was a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for taking time of your day to do this interview. I appreciate it very much.
Anytime, Bruce.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the hard money tab.